A new vision of our future with regard to gas is required.
Ted Stevens tells lawmakers to change course on the gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 12th of March. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, spoiled meat dampens Lance Mackey's Iditarod.
They run on straight kibble. They're down in power a little bit. And nutrition.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Former Senator Ted Stevens made a rare public appearance in Anchorage today, calling for the state to drop its current plan for developing a gas line from the North Slope to the North American markets. Speaking at a Commonwealth North lunch, he said demand for gas in the lower 48 is falling off, and the Asian market is much more promising. Stevens says the state should pursue a bullet line to Kenai. The gas would be liquefied at a plant there and then shipped to India, China, Japan, and Korea.
The bullet line will be the largest project underway in the United States if it's undertaken. It will represent Alaska's contribution to job creation and economic recovery in our nation. And when completed to Kenai, it would save the LNG plant there and possibly lead to its expansion.
Stevens says the state can't move fast enough to drop the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. And he says the state should make a significant investment in the bullet line.
Just say we'll put up half of this money now, and we will ask you to present us a plan for cooperation between the state and the producers to get that line built to Kenai in time to restart the Kenai plant and to keep it fulfilling demands in Japan or elsewhere if they want to buy it.
The speech already has state lawmakers talking in Juneau, according to Larry Persily, a legislative aide. Persily will soon be sworn in as the federal gas line pipeline coordinator. He says he's looking forward to talking with Stevens about the issue, but he disagrees with the former senator.
Yes, the market has changed in the last few years. That doesn't mean there's a permanent, impenetrable blockage to the Alaska project. Just means we got to be a little smarter and think about it. How much do we want it? You know, how much risk are the producers, the pipeline company, the state, the federal government willing to take? So every project, be it North America or Asia, has its own problems, its own costs to overcome.
Persily says it's true there is growth in the Asian market, but there's also lots of competition to meet that demand. The Parnell administration today gave its side in the debate over legislation that would separate oil and gas taxes, APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The world can change dramatically, and you do not want to set your policy based upon one expected outcome.
Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin shared the administration's view of the future of the state's oil and gas tax structure and gave the Senate Finance Committee details of the effects of separating oil and gas taxes in a volatile industry in an uncertain world.
The facts that we believe today do not pan out oftentimes tomorrow, and that what we believe today are the dynamics between supply and demand are not the same ones that are going to drive our expectations even 1 or 2 years from now.
Legislative references to the need to separate oil and gas taxes have been based on the presumption that current economic conditions will not change until a gas line from the North Slope to North American market goes into operation in 10 to 15 years. When oil costs $120 a barrel and gas costs $8 for the equivalent amount of energy, the state would lose $2 billion a year in revenue under the current tax structure. However, Galvin looks at a different scenario. He says it's very possible that gas prices could rise to $15. And his calculations show that if the legislature changes its tax, the state would then lose $1.6 billion a year. His calculations show the state gets more under current conditions by changing the tax, decoupling oil and gas. But they also show the state gets more under very possible conditions when gas actually will begin to flow toward Canada without decoupling oil and gas. He puts the question back on legislators.
So where will it be in 2020, 2045? I'm not going to be the one to try to speculate at this point.
Economist Roger Marks, under contract to the legislature, agreed with much of what Galvin had to say, and he doesn't make any prediction on future oil and gas prices. He left one caution to lawmakers.
Oil and gas are very different resources, and they have the potential to be valued much differently. And we laid out the consequences of what coupling the taxes for two resources that have the potential of being taxed much differently can be.
The Finance Committee is still working on the bill, and more changes have been promised for consideration in the next few days. It still has to go through the House and needs to be on the governor's desk by April 6th to cover tax exemptions the state's promised for the next step in the gas line development process. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Iditarod leader Jeff King is closing in on the Galena checkpoint, with Lance Mackey and Hugh Neff doing what they can to try to catch up. The other lead mushers, including Mitch Seavey, Hans Scott, and Sonny Lindner, are camped out at the Ruby checkpoint. While King has built a sizable lead, some mushers behind him are struggling with issues related to dog food, rough trail, and cold temperatures. APRN trail reporter Tim Bodoni filed this report from Ruby.
The last two times that the Iditarod took the northern route, King was in second place into Ruby. But this year, he got to enjoy the gourmet meal that awaits the first musher to the Yukon each year. The main course, appropriately, was Alaska King Crab. After the meal, King said that he's having the magic ride so far.
You know, they're very healthy and fluid. Nobody is sore. They don't even have a sore foot. And they're eating great. They seem fast.
Each of the top teams into Ruby made the 100-mile run from Cripple nonstop, averaging around 11 miles per hour. Temperatures between 20 and 30 below were a factor in mushers' decisions to push further down the trail instead of stopping to camp. Lance Mackey says that charging ahead to a checkpoint is a better way to conserve time and effort.
Even with a long run like that, you know, it's easier on the dogs to go a little bit slower, a little bit farther, and get comfortable on a bed of straw and a nice hot meal. Now you can do that out there too, but it takes twice as long to make snow, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, it's definitely the plan.
Mackey also reports that he's having issues with his dog food. The meat that Mackey and some other mushers included in their drop bags had apparently been thawed and refrozen, spoiling the meat. That leaves Mackey in the difficult position of trying to keep his dog team properly fed with dry kibble and supplements.
Like in Cripple, I left a whole 60, 70 pounds of meat, you know, for the birds, basically, which is a huge waste. And again, you know, they run on straight kibble. They're down in power a little bit and nutrition.
Fairbanks musher Ken Anderson, who's vying for a spot in the top 10, was aware of the spoiled meat problem that was afflicting other mushers, but says it didn't affect him due to his decision to blow through the Ophir and Cripple checkpoints in favor of camping in between.
I carried a lot of stuff from Takotna with me, a lot of stuff, to avoid Ophir, and then I got some fat at Cripple, which fat usually doesn't go bad. So my dogs are totally healthy, and the vets commented that they have the most weight on them of any team that's here. So that's good news. I've been eating everything.
Canadian musher Sebastian Schnula was in the lead at several early checkpoints before mushers completed their mandatory 24-hour layovers. Since then, he's slipped back in the standings in a race he insists will be his last Iditarod as well. His time from Cripple to Ruby was almost 2 hours slower than King's, and the extra time was not spent camping. Instead, it was spent slogging through what Schnula called one of the worst runs of his career.
I had a chain of screw-ups right from the get-go. I left and had to turn around and drop a dog, which is already not a good start. I had the absolutely wrong runner plastic on. I was grinding away. Hans, who left an hour after me. In 22 miles, he made 1 hour on me. So if he wouldn't have given me rhinoplasty, I probably would still be out there grinding away. But then I couldn't get it on. It took me like half an hour to get that damn plastic on. So all in all, it was not a very pleasant run.
Schnuller was 7th place into Ruby, and despite the mishaps on Friday, reported no major problems with his dog team. After the sideways glaciers and hilly windblown trail that dominates the section from Cripple to Ruby, the mushers will drop onto the flat plain of the Yukon River, where a few inches of recent snowfall have given the trail some cushion. Temperatures will remain cooler than average, with overnight lows for Friday predicted to be around 30 below on the river. Reporting from Ruby, this is Tim Bodoni.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a World War II pilot finally gets her due.
It was immeasurably inspiring and exciting and deeply meaningful.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
More than 1,000 skilled aviators who served the United States during World War II are finally getting formal recognition for their service. This week, the Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs, were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. 3 Alaskans are among their ranks, and one journeyed from Juneau to Washington for Wednesday's ceremony. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Ellen Campbell was about 20 years old when World War II broke out. She had a calling to fly and dreamed of perhaps being a stewardess. But then she found out about the elite WASP program, in which women were pilots.
I was called a test pilot, not the glamorous kind of experimental planes, but new planes had to have a certain amount of time on them. Planes that had been damaged in accidents and so forth had to have a certain amount of flight time on them.
After earning her wings, Campbell was stationed in Jackson, Mississippi. She requested a twin-engine base because she liked powerful planes.
I just always thought it would be exciting to keep on going, although my favorite plane was the AT-6. And that one we had in advanced flight training when we got our wings. And it was an exciting plane because all of a sudden the horsepower was increased. And that was both exciting and somewhat intimidating.
That was 65 years ago. Ellen Campbell went on to marry, raise children, and move with her husband to Juneau. She volunteers at her church and helps women in prison. For years, there was minimal, if any, recognition of her service with the WASP. In fact, when the Air Force selected a handful of women for pilot training in the 1970s, it mistakenly touted them as the first. Campbell is now 88 years old, and her service is being recognized.
Today, we are gathered here in Emancipation Hall to honor the courageous patriotism of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, to honor them with the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest honor Congress can bestow.
That's U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Wednesday's ceremony in the Capitol drew one of the biggest crowds ever for such an event. About 200 WASP made the journey to Washington of the 1,074 who served. Senator K. Billy Hutchison, a sponsor of the legislation to get them the gold medal, says during the war, they flew over 60 million miles, doing everything men did except combat.
All these women volunteered to serve our country in wartime. They paid their own way to Texas for training, and when the war ended, the program ended, they paid their own way back home. And those who were killed in action were buried by their families, often with contributions taken up by the women of the WASP.
The 38 women killed in action did not have the American flag draped over their caskets. Hutchison says Wednesday's ceremony tried to right some of those wrongs.
We are closing a circle today of unrecognized achievement that began with the Tuskegee Airmen and the Code Talkers and today the wasp.
Down we dive, spotting our flame from under, off with one hell of a roar.
During Wednesday's ceremony, Ellen Campbell reconnected with old friends. 6 decades ago, when they were pilots, Campbell says some were single, some had husbands serving overseas, and some were young war widows, using that time for their vigil of grief. She says all bonded together for a greater purpose, which is finally being recognized.
It was immeasurably inspiring and exciting and deeply meaningful.
Today, over 64,000 women serve in the Air Force, and dozens of them were in the audience. Presenters used words to describe the WASPs, like fearless, formidable, spunk, and moxie. But Ellen Campbell has another legacy she strives for.
More than anything, I would like to inspire people in goodness and helpfulness and joy of life. That's where it is. It's there for us, each one.
Two other Alaskan women served with the WASP, Fairbanksons Ginny Wood and Nancy Baker, will be honored by Senator Lisa Murkowski next month when she travels north. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
A respiratory virus particularly harmful to children is continuing to spread in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. In many areas around the state, the RSV outbreak seems to be slowing, but the Bethel region was hit late by the virus. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
Respiratory syncytial virus may seem like a cold, but it's more worrisome because it can cause serious breathing problems and can easily turn into pneumonia, especially for young children and infants. For weeks, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Hospital in Bethel was inundated with patients suffering from RSV. Then things started looking better.
We'd turned the corner.
Lori Pruitt-Jakoyek, an infection control nurse.
Our emergency room was a little less busy last weekend, and Monday looked pretty good. But Tuesday, we again saw an upswing in cases, and we've continued to be busy the rest of the week.
The spread of RSV is not uncommon in parts of Alaska during February and March months. But Pruitt-Jakoyek says this year's outbreak is different.
This year, we've definitely seen a lot more children with RSV.
The clinics in the Bethel Hospital are so full that patients have had to fly to Anchorage just to be seen by a provider.
Because our inpatient unit has been on divert because we've been full.
Coastal communities are the hardest hit this year, but more cases are showing up in interior villages of the YK Delta. Meanwhile, the RSV outbreak seems to be slowing in other regions of the state. Infection numbers are down around Kotzebue, Nome, and Barrow. Symptoms of RSV can include a fever and labored breathing. RSV is a virus and can live on surfaces for several hours, so washing hands, toys, and things like doorknobs are a good way to help prevent its spread. Someone carrying the virus can be contagious for 1 to 2 weeks, so infected children should be kept at home. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Villagers in Perryville and Chignik Lake are mourning the death of Candace Berner. The special education teacher was killed earlier this week in an animal attack in Chignik Lake. Rick Luthy with the Lake and Peninsula School District is in Chignik Lake today. He says she will be badly missed.
There was a celebration of Candace's life last night in Perryville that was put on by the staff and the students there. And I believe there is another one planned for Chignik Bay, and I believe that's going to take place tonight.
Luthy says Berner was a well-known and popular teacher at all the sites where she worked.
Miss Berner made a wonderful impact on many people in a short amount of time. She was one of these staff members that just has a way of making real strong connections real quick, and she was able to do that. Candace has worked for us since August, and she had been into Chignik Lake along with all of her other sites many times, and this was a special place for her to go. She felt very comfortable and at home, and as she did in the other sites.
He says the students in the schools Berner served are getting help in dealing with her death. Berner's body was discovered Monday in Chignik Lake. Alaska State Troopers say her death was caused by an animal attack, most likely by wolves.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, unlocking Alaska's resource potential. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
Alaska's congressional delegation met today with the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. NOAA Director Jane Lubchenco and the new Director of Fisheries, Eric Schwab, talked policy in Congressman Don Young's office. The Alaskans are concerned about the proposed critical habitat area in Cook Inlet to protect the beluga whale and other decisions related to the Endangered Species Act. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says the ESA threatens to harm Alaska's economy.
Whether it's the golden loon or the murrelet or the stellar sea lions or the ice seal, the ring seal, the spotted seal, the polar bear, the beluga, and the feeling back home is that we are under siege.
The delegation said they wanted to send a united message despite their party differences. NOAA's Lubchenco would not comment after the meeting, and a spokeswoman said only that it was productive. The one-of-a-kind municipal life insurance policy for Anchorage former mayor, the late George Sullivan, continues to attract Assembly attention. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
On February 2nd, the Anchorage Assembly approved a $193,000 payment to the George M. Sullivan Irrevocable Life Insurance Trust. From 1967 through 1981, George Sullivan was mayor of the city that then evolved into the present unified municipality. He was the father of Anchorage's current mayor, Dan Sullivan. Because the elder Sullivan's health prevented him from obtaining life insurance, the Anchorage Assembly in January 1982 authorized a life insurance policy for, quote, the remainder of his life at the same rate and with the same coverage as in existence on January 1, 1982, the day when he left office. George Sullivan died in September 2009. Last month's Assembly vote to pay the $193,000 was 9-1, with only Harriet Drummond voting no. Now some Assembly members, including Chair Pat Flynn, want more background about this unique life insurance arrangement. In a phone conversation, Flynn said he's requested more information from the Department of Law.
I learned after we voted on the ordinance authorizing the disbursement of the life insurance monies that Mayor Sullivan was the trustee of that trust. That fact was not before us or on the record at our Assembly meeting.
Flynn said earlier he called the law department and was told the trustee information was not required to be on the payment memorandum. Flynn said he's asked the law department to document that position. He also has a second request.
It would also be useful to see a little more in-depth discussion of how they came to the conclusion that the municipality was obligated to make this payment, which was the assertion offered to us in the documentation we did receive prior to our vote.
Flynn described his queries as informational, not investigative. After this week's regular mayor's press conference, municipal attorney Dennis Wheeler explained the basis for the department's recommendation to honor the life insurance agreement.
Our office reviewed not only the documents from 1982, but the history of receiving premiums and the number of administrations that touched on it, including the 2002 legal analysis and the contact with Aetna at that time. It became apparent to us that we had taken on the obligation and needed to honor that obligation.
Assemblymember Drummond will introduce a resolution requesting the Assembly hire an independent legal counsel to review the entire life insurance arrangement. The review would focus on 9 questions revolving around the legal basis for the municipality to create and subsequently pay a life insurance policy. This is Len Anderson.
An unusual pair of TV stars got together in Homer this week to shoot some footage on the Homer spit. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the story.
Security was pretty tight at the entrance of Homer's deep water dock Thursday afternoon.
as a 30-member production crew worked on a series of 4 television commercials for Geico, the insurance company known for their quirky ads. All that's known about the ads is that one of Geico's famous cavemen, played by actor Mack Woodend, is involved, as is the FV Time Bandit, the Homer-based crab boat made famous by the Discovery Channel program Deadliest Catch. The cast and crew of the shoot, which includes Woodend and Time Bandit Captain Jonathan Hillstrand, were supposed to shoot earlier in the week, but a severe winter storm prevented them from making it to Homer until Wednesday. Anchorage television station KTUU caught up with Hillstrand and Woodend while they were stuck on the side of the Seward Highway Tuesday waiting for a pair of avalanches to be cleared. Even a seasoned crab boat captain like Hillstrand seems surprised by the nasty weather.
We were going to do it last night, and we got turned around, and then we decided to just drive down because we're a tough Alaska guy. Uh-huh. We can make it. That's no, right. We're not making it.
Homer Harbor Master Brian Hawkins said the Geico folks called about a month ago to ask permission to shoot the commercials at the city-owned dock. Shooting is taking place on the dock and aboard the Time Bandit, says Hawkins, and is scheduled to last through Friday. Hawkins says the Homer Spit is no stranger to film productions.
There's been several, actually. I can't think of all the commercials, maybe not to this scale commercial, but there's been film clips and actually a motion picture was parts of a motion picture was done here 2 years ago.
Although the Homer City Council recently approved a resolution to join the Alaska Film Group, a nonprofit organization that promotes the film industry in Alaska, the city currently has no means to collect revenue from productions shot in Homer, nor does it require a permit, says city manager Walt Reedy.
The city didn't play a role in it at all. We were just informed that it was happening, but of course we're pleased about it. I think, you know, Homer's a natural for that sort of thing, and we're pleased to see it happening.
Reedy could not confirm or deny rumors that Mayor Jim Hornaday had given the Geico caveman the key to the city. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Tim Bodoni and Ruby, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported, as did Dave Donaldson. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
And by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. ANSEP is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move on to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. To learn more, search ANSEP on the web, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.